You're listening to Grumpire with your hosts, Elby and Andrew.
Welcome to Grumpire.
What's a Grumpire, Elby?
Well, we are, apparently. This is the podcast companion to our brand new website, Grumpire.com. Grumpire is an entertainment site that we hope explores film in a bit of a different way than what's already out there.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, what I see online a lot is what I call the positivity parade. It's people giving needlessly, overly positive reviews to things that may not necessarily deserve it. People seem afraid to say what they really think about something because it goes against popular opinion. So Grumpire is there to promote fair criticism, which seems like a no-brainer, but you'd be surprised.
So what's the difference between the website and the podcast?
Well, like I said, the site is there to promote fair criticism, like be it positive or a negative, though it's probably going to be more positive most of the time. But on the podcast, we take off the kid gloves, and like MTV's The Real World, we stop being polite and start getting real. Our guests are going to bring two movies to us.
Wait, two movies?
Yeah. One's going to be a film that they don't like, but is beloved by many people out there, and we'll explore the reasons why they don't like it. And then the other film is an alternate that follows a similar theme, but satisfies our guest much more.
So our first guest is Boston stand-up comedian Ken Reed, who is also a contributing writer for Grumpire and has his very own podcast, TV Guidance Counselor. It's long-running. He's got tons of guests,
there's
like celebrities, celebrities, celebrities. He like flies out to LA and wherever he can find celebrities, actually.
Totally.
And he ambushes him. I don't think he ambushes him, but he's like old-timey reporter. He's got the press pass in his hat.
Definitely. I can see Ken wearing that.
I need to get a podcast interview with you. One of those. Not really. That's, it's not what he does. Anyway, and he's got a Spotify account where you can find his stand-up comedy. So you can just look up his name, Ken Reed. K-E-N-R-E-I-D. On Spotify and listen to him be funny.
He's very funny.
Very good storyteller. You know, Elby?
Wait, yeah, what?
Well, you know, audience, too. What you're about to hear is somewhat appropriately, even though it was accidentally, glitchy.
A little bit.
But given what we're going to be talking about, it kind of fits.
Yeah.
You know? But please bear with us, and also please, please forgive my Ed McMahon, horrible Ed McMahon thing. I thought that was my role in this whole thing, so I just swung hard for it, and I think I missed at the very beginning. So please bear with the glitches, and bear with my Ed McMahon. It's gone in a few seconds, the Ed McMahon thing, so, but forgive me, alright? I just had to get that off my chest.
Now on with the show.
Ken Reed, how are you doing?
I'm all right. I've heard better at McMahon's.
Elby, how are you doing?
I'm doing.
You're doing. What are we doing?
Oh, wait, this is the show?
Yes. What are we doing?
We're talking to Ken Reed today about a movie that he does not like. Ken.
There's a lot of movies I don't like.
Well, wow, that's good.
Specifically.
Yeah, yeah, this is a specific one. Do you want me to reveal it?
Why don't you tell us what it is?
Okay, it's The Matrix, which I don't like for reasons that's the movie's fault, but also reasons that's not quite the movie's fault. So I don't know which one you want me to go through first here.
All right, well, before we get further into The Matrix, let's just listen to the trailer.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. Once the Matrix has you...
They're watching you, Neo. You're in danger.
Later is sooner than you think.
Dodge this.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. The Matrix.
Okay, now that we've listened to the trailer of The Matrix, and I'm sure that if you were born after 1999... Yeah, come on, you have to have seen this movie.
Everyone on the planet knows what this movie is.
That's a problem.
Is that one of the reasons why you don't like it?
Sort of.
Okay.
Did you want me to elaborate?
Yes,
no, that's just
that's enough.
It's been a great show, everybody.
Yes, please elaborate. Well, okay, what's the most prescient reason you don't like The Matrix?
It's incredibly derivative. It is...
Yes.
it's sort of the... I have a similar issue with The Matrix that I have with Quentin Tarantino movies, in that it's probably a great movie if you've never seen any good movies.
Okay.
So the best you can say about the filmmakers is they have good taste. It's essentially it's like the Puff Daddy of movie making, in that you're sampling better movies.
Okay. So, well, let's dig into the samples. What are you seeing here in
The
Matrix?
Well, there's obviously the Hong Kong cinema influence, to the point where they hired, I think Corey Yoon did the
Yuen Wu Ping.
Right. And who was one of the Seven Little Fortunes, I think. So he was along with, like, Yuen Biu, and Corey Yoon was in that group, because they all adopted the name Yoon from their teacher.
Okay.
But all of the things that blew people away with the fight choreography were just stuff we'd been seeing in Hong Kong movies for the last 20 years before that.
Right.
And the plot is incredibly derivative of the very short-lived American cinematic obsession with virtual reality from the early 90s.
Yeah.
And The Terminator.
Yeah, and The Terminator very much as well. But, the movie's essentially The Lawnmower Man.
Yes.
With Hong Kong fight scenes and some Terminator visuals.
I'm going to go further. It's Lawnmower Man 2, Job's War.
Yeah, which is more of a compliment, because that is the better of the two films.
Yeah, and neither have to do with Stephen King, really.
Right, but it's virtuosity, it's the 13th floor... You know, an arcade.
arcade. You're going to go to arcade.
Yeah.
Elby, you probably don't know. I don't know.
No, I don't know arcade.
Arcade is a Full Moon feature.
Correct.
So.
With Seth Green.
No wonder I don't know
Seth
it.
Green
okay.
is in it.
Seth Green and
Megan Ward.
Oh, she's in cutie it. Megan
yeah.
Ward.
It's an earlier Megan Ward film, too. So a lot of earlier films of that era, early 90s, late 80s, were earlier films by these notable actors. Mm-hmm. Ended up being Charles Band movies.
Everybody starts somewhere. The only virtual reality movie that The Matrix is not influenced by is Brain Scan.
Okay, that's the Eddie Furlong film.
Correct. Written by Andrew Kevin Walker, who did Seven and 8mm.
That's his name. Yeah, I was riffing on that on a different podcast, and I couldn't remember his name. It's like, Waller? What? What's his last name?
I think it's Walker. Yeah,
okay, it's Walker. You're right. Andrew Kevin Walker. Seven.
You know, I'm glad that you actually first brought up, like, the culture of the 90s that was happening at the time. Like, everyone was really obsessed with virtual reality. But also, everyone was really obsessed with, like, conspiracy theories and things like that, too. Like, stuff that came out of the X-Files.
Yeah.
And The Matrix. Like, I completely think that The Matrix gave birth to this, like, Reddit mentality.
Absolutely.
Well, there's also an X-Files episode, LB, that actually has a virtual reality character come to life.
Right.
Come out of the virtual reality and run amok.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the one, I don't even want to call it an innovation, but that's the one difference in The Matrix, in that previous sort of iterations of this story were either a virtual reality character comes into the real world, which is basically Freddy Krueger, or that people are sort of willingly living in this false reality, so they've been sort of consumed by sort of Second Life type thing, and this is that, but the people, they don't know it. That's right. The Twilight Zone twist. It's all a dream. You know, it's just like, yeah, okay.
All right, Biggie Smalls, I get it. Hey, so let me ask you, when you saw this for the first time, was it in 99 and was it in the theater?
No, I avoided this movie. Actually, I watched this movie in its entirety for the first time today.
Okay, wow, so you've actually... Okay, I can do this with Adam Sandler movies. It's actually possible to say, I don't like this movie, and be correct, and not having ever seen it.
Yeah, I mean,
and then maybe once fumbling upon it, and then finally eventually seeing all of Big Daddy or something, and you're like, I was right!
Yeah, I mean, I've seen so much, you know, pieces of it here and there, and it was so ubiquitous. I'm like, yeah, alright, okay.
So, today is the first time you ever saw it.
Yeah, time I sat down and watched it start to finish, yeah.
Elby, what's your first time with this?
I didn't see it in the theater or in 99. I definitely saw it maybe like in 2000 or 2001. I don't whenever it was on home video and, like, the guys rented it, college dorm sort of thing.
Of course and, guys rented it in the college dorm.
I know.
What was your impression, though, Elby?
Well, I mean, I dug it at the time. I feel really dumb saying this. Like, it was one of the first times I had actually thought about that. Like, you know, the veil being lifted from my face sort of thing. Like, I don't know. I mean, it seems really... I don't know, juvenile now. Like, that whole, like, allegory of the cave thing, you know?
Yeah. So it's a science fiction allegory of the cave, and that was you feeling, like, whoa.
Like, wow, I've never thought about this before. It's so mind-blowing, man.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's also sort of like occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge and Jacob's Ladder, which, again, are slightly different, like, dismount, in that they're like, this is an alternate life flashing before your eyes kind of thing. But it's, you know, it's that twist.
Right. And there are movies that, like you just mentioned, that do it a lot better. That's not like... I mean, the thing about The Matrix is it's so simple. Like, it's, like, the philosophy of this movie is, like, very, very, like, just philosophy 101, you know?
It's like a dumb person's version of a smart movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very plainly stated. Everything is very easy to digest. So, yeah, it's, I mean, it's fine. It's good if you are a young person, I think. Like, to watch this and you start to maybe understand or, like, start to question things around you, like, that's important. But, like, as an adult, like, seeing this later, it just really does not have the same effect at all.
You know what's weird, too, is that I actually like Johnny Mnemonic, which also starred Keanu Reeves and was a cyberpunk movie and featured sort of a somewhat similar worldview. I just didn't like the execution of this, I think. You know, like, it also reminded me of, you know, like, animes like Ghost in the Shell, like the original Ghost in the Shell, which had come out before this and that sort of thing, where I was just kind of like, okay.
Yeah. Well, the further of these films actually have anime going on. So there's an Animatrix
disc,
which actually has a bunch of short stories, some of them dealing with the whole uprising of the robots, which is iRobot meets the Terminator. And the other stories are just little stories about people experiencing glitches in the Matrix. The one called The Haunted House is really fantastic animation by a company called Studio 4C. It's just one of the best things you'll see animation-wise. But it could just be a cool animated weird haunted house story autonomous from The Matrix. It doesn't have to be The Matrix. But that they say this is the reason why is because there was this weird glitch house. Yeah, okay. Tie it into The Matrix. Cool.
Yeah.
The rest of them are kind of like, I mean, animation. I'm not the biggest fan of animation. It's weird.
I like it. I enjoy animation.
I had my moment in the 90s of, like, indulging in a lot of animation. Now only the cream of the crops.
Yeah, like. Heavy Metal the movie, Felix the cat.
No, Ralph Bakshi, no.
No,
he's too depressing.
When I was in college, again, another college Matrix story, I thought it was real cute to try to impress boys when they'd be like, oh, what's your favorite Matrix movie or whatever? And I would be like, I like the Animatrix.
That one episode. It's the best thing.
Yeah. I mean, that is, you are correct. Have you ever seen, they did a whole animated series of Supernatural?
No.
I've heard about that.
Yeah. It aired in Japan, and it's in canon, and it's just very strange.
And I know that they did a Scooby-Doo episode.
Right.
They did, but that was unrelated.
Yeah. So when I saw this in 99, my impression of it was, I saw it in the theater, my impression of it was that, so I was 25, I had come off of Star Wars really hard in the early 90s, and I was like, screw Star Wars. Star Wars is idiots and stupids,
right.
And I just really hated it. And reason why I bring up Star Wars is because I never really had a movie or a franchise of something that I latched onto of my own mind willingly, right? And Fifth Element came out, and I was like, yeah, Fifth Element, that might be my Star Wars. And then nothing more happened with Fifth Element, so I just watched it over and over again. And then The Matrix came out, and I was like, whoa. This is talking to me, you know, the Christ allegory, all of that stuff, which is so on the frickin' nose.
Right.
But it always
Alice in Wonderland. stuff. Follow the white rabbit. You know what's stupid about the white rabbit scene? It's that you can hardly see the white rabbit under the green light that they shine on her shoulder.
Yeah, Alice in Wonderland is, like, alluded to in movies second only to The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
But, you know, they really... Yeah, it's real on the nose. It's real dumb. I mean, although any movie that has a chosen one... plotline, the sort of King Arthur plotline, I mean, it's gonna have that Christ allegory, and there's a billion of them. This one's just particularly dumb.
Yeah, but at the time, not you, apparently, but all of us, we fell hook, line, and sinker for that. At least, like, I'm always thinking, and I'm not saying I'm thinking smart, because I'm not the smartest guy in the world, I don't think, but I'm always thinking about what I'm ingesting, what I'm watching, what I'm listening to. Or at least I try to. I found myself recently being like, those are the lyrics to that song I've never noticed, and I heard the song thousands of times probably by now, you know? So, autopilot is a thing.
Again?
What? Am I talking about Third Eye Blind?
Well, I think you, you know, the Matrix could just as well have been called Can I Graduate?
Well, it is, like Elby said, it's like a philosophy 101 sort of thing. And that's nice. It's good to explore those ideas and concepts. And if you're young and uneducated, I suppose, and this is a gateway into it. Unfortunately, the second film, which you haven't seen.
No.
But I really desperately want you to see the scene with the architect, the guy who apparently made the Matrix.
Because of course.
Oh, man, I want you to see that scene.
Andrew,
so you can roll your eyes so hard that I can hear it here in Texas.
Is the architect God, Andrew?
No, I don't know who the architect... It's Will Ferrell. Will Ferrell played the architect in a skit.
Of course.
A parody of it for the MTV Movie Awards, and it was a really, actually, on-the-nose, very solid, funny parody of it.
I thought you were gonna say the MTV Mutant Award.
Well, might as well.
That
right?
I would watch. Yeah. I mean, this movie also suffers from the general conceit of it is not. I don't need stuff to be believable or realistic. I just need it to make sense within the context of the world that the movie presents.
Yeah.
And they do not successfully do that. Like the
what doesn't make sense?
Why the machines wouldn't need people? They need them as battery. Like it's stupid. And if they did need them, yeah. And if they did need them to do that, why would they need to create? If it's just they need the physical biological material, like they don't have to create a fictional world for them to believe they're living in.
Yeah. So that concept, you're right, has been shattered time and time again, except for the apologists who are like, yeah, but because it's good in battery people. But you're not the first person, obviously, because this is the first time you've seen the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's
but you're not the first person to be like, no, that doesn't make sense, to the point where there are certain scientists or experts who know about how the human body is bioelectric and all that stuff, and they have calculated how much energy they put out, and they'll be like, this isn't good to power a computer, a laptop.
Yeah,
you know?
Solar power would have been a lot more effective.
But they scorched the sky!
Yeah.
Haven't you seen the Animatrix?
The machines are in charge. There's no sun.
Yeah, you know, if you want to see a bad sci-fi movie about no sun, just rent Highlander 2 and you'll be a lot happier.
I am a lot happier. That's a movie I saw in the theater and I had a hoot and a holler.
So did I.
And they're flying around on their little hobgoblin mobile.
Yeah, Michael
Ironside.
Virginia Madsen as an eco-terrorist. I mean, it's a great movie.
Yeah, it's really bad, though.
It's
but
terrible.
It's fun.
Yeah, but I could forgive it for one movie. Like, it's, you know, it's not a good reveal. It's not a good conceit. But one movie's worth of mythology, you go, fine. You know, it's the 13th floor sort of movie. But now we're putting it in a whole mythology in a series? No. You can't hang anything on that.
Well, they try. They try desperately. And I'm just going to go further and tell you what they do have in the other movies that they don't even touch. Werewolves, vampires, zombies, ghouls, any kind of anomaly that you can think of. Because, after all, it's a computer simulation. And sometimes programming and viruses occur and there's some weird crap going on.
That's
how we make sense of monsters, dude. And they only have these two albino ghost guys
but
with dreads.
I mean,
they suck.
that's the holodeck on Star Trek The Next Generation. And
that is.
Every third episode of Star Trek The Next Generation is, we woke up, something weird's happening. Oh, it turns out we're actually in the holodeck and we didn't know.
And it's a glitch in the holodeck.
Yeah.
The program is run amok.
Yeah.
Oh, the bullets actually now hurt us.
So it's like a third of Star Trek episodes is basically The Matrix.
For real. You're right. There's a movie that came out after The Matrix was a big hit, and it was a cheaper made film, and I was, again, on board with it. And it was Equilibrium.
Equilibrium's a much better movie.
Ah, it's stupid as hell, though.
But
stupid as hell. But I was on board. I was totally on board. Then I showed my friend, my oldest friend from high school. I showed him because he's like a total normie. But he watched the thing and he was like, this is stupid. And I'm like, really excited and like enjoying it. And, yeah, this is cool. Isn't this good? And he's like, no, it's dumb. And he breaks it down like we're breaking down The Matrix. And it's the same problems that The Matrix has. It's super derivative.
Yeah, it's 1984. The Running Man, it's, you know, Fahrenheit 451.
A Brave New World, and
it's
all kinds of things. And it's just also like a 14-year-old wrote it.
Right, which is why 14-year-olds loved it.
Yeah.
and which is why these sort of alt-right Reddit boards have embraced The Matrix as this life philosophy and, you know, have ridiculous things like, oh man, I'm red-pilled. It's like, shut up. Like, they don't even know. The funniest part is they don't know their tough guy, like, mythology is based on Alice in Wonderland.
Hey, you know what? I'll tell you. Some of my favorite Disney stuff is, like, Sword in the Stone, which is a King Arthur thing.
Yep.
Just a reference earlier.
Black Cauldron.
Sleeping Beauty. Totally great art. And then Alice in Wonderland. It's pretty great.
Which
Disney's
is why...
I mean, I don't go anywhere else with Disney, but that's where I stay.
Cauldron is where I stop with the animation, but I love Black Cauldron. Up to and including Black Cauldron.
Okay. But you get what I'm saying. Like, Alice in Wonderland, yeah.
Oh, Alice in Wonderland is pretty cool. Great, but you wouldn't normally have, like, tough guys being like, you gotta wake up, man.
I'm saying I'm plenty tough and I like Alice in Wonderland.
Well, also, I'm saying that you can also use as a response to those people, you can continue the Alice in Wonderland motif and tell them to eat you.
Right. Grow small, grow big. Yeah.
Eat me. Drink me.
Right. I was just joking. I'm just trying to say that I'm a tough dude. I'm not really.
We all know. You're one of those Sleeping Beauty tough guys.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to knock you out so well that a prince is going to have to kiss you to wake you up.
You know, speaking of a 14-year-old philosophy, or, you know, 14-year-old understanding of things, you guys, I totally found this, like, you know, I was going through my stuff, and I found this, like, old notebook that I had in high school. It is full of, like, just, I mean, you know, when you're in high school and you write just really dumb poems, but you think they're, like, the best things that, you know, they're really deep.
It's angst.
I found this, yeah, the angst, and they're like, this has purpose. Well, I found this notebook that's, like, completely full of my old high school poetry, and can you believe that I actually wrote a poem about The Matrix?
I can believe that.
You guys want to
hear it? What's the time frame of this, LB? Were you 14 years old? You weren't 14 in 99.
No, I mean, I was 14 in 1995, so it's, like, really insane that I found this notebook full of poetry about The Matrix.
That's weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
Weird. Is it a glitch?
It's not like... Maybe it is a glitch. I mean, it's totally not like I just wrote it yesterday or anything.
So are you going to read it or what?
I'll read it. Okay, so here's my poem about The Matrix. We are all a simulation. Red, blue, tills make us green. The primary colors of our primary motivations, our primary memory. 99% CPU. The Oracle will see you. Ain't no time for bullet time, when life's nothing but a cyber crime. Tap into the system, we're only hacking ourselves. Wake up! We are all a simulation. Asleep on a binary vacation. Just gotta unplug, man. Do you know Kung Fu? I do. There it is. Thank you.
That was fantastic, yeah.
Thank you.
You know Kung Fu?
I do.
I enjoyed the pentameter of the poetry.
Thank you. I was learning about that in sophomore English class at the time.
Yeah. Were you also influenced by So I Married an Axe Murderer, perhaps, perchance?
Maybe a little bit.
Because it sounds like it's got a little bit of that flavor.
Well, you know, that happened in the 90s. Everybody, you know, went to their open mic night and they read their poems in front of everybody at the coffee houses with their giant lattes.
Yeah, it was, you know, and then you had the slam poetry going on.
Yeah, it's appropriate.
It was, and also was a better version of The Matrix than The Matrix.
All right, so can we talk a little bit about the fashions of The Matrix?
Yes.
Yeah. They are as silly as any 1970s sci-fi vision of the future. Like, the fashions of The Matrix, and I thought this at the time as well, were as silly as Rollerball or Logan's Run.
But okay, Logan's Run really looks of the 70s. It really looks that bad with the flared pant legs and the flowing silk semi transparent negligee. I don't know what they are, but they're not really clothes that the ladies are running.
They're
around
called swingers robes.
There you go. Swingers robes.
Wait, did you learn that from your Sex Life show?
I did. They gave me a glossary.
God. Swingers robes. Is that, yes, from Logan's Run? Yes.
Here's your technical jargon manual.
Thank you. Swingers robes. Gotcha. So, but in The Matrix, they're all like, everybody's in bondage gear. Everybody is some sort of fetish gear wearing person.
But not really. Like, it's more like everyone's dressed like Blade.
Blade. Well, but I mean, there's a sort of fetish motif to it.
Slightly.
I mean, like,
but I would consider, like, the Cenobites of Hellraiser are in fetish gear.
Okay, well, I'm talking about, like, a person going to not a common goth club, but a club that's goth on Thursday nights.
These look less like goth club outfits to me and more like they're hunting owls.
what
like if people like if Ted Nugent hunted bats, this is how he would dress.
I just think that the Wachowskis really had a thing for fetish stuff. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, you think?
Actually,
well, yeah, I mean, I love the movie Bound. I was actually excited for The Matrix because Bound was great, their first movie, and mm-hmm. then I saw the trailer and read what it was about and I was like, oh, oops.
Now, so as far as martial arts goes, you're not at all in the slightest impressed by any of it because you had seen Jackie Chan and Jet Li do that sort of stuff, and Jet Li used wires and Jackie Chan didn't, but yeah. You'd seen basically everything that they did in The Matrix except for move the camera around in bullet time.
Yeah, I mean, the choreography was fine. It just wasn't amazing. Here's a movie that I find has a U.S. movie that is more impressive. Hong Kong fight choreography would be The One with Jet Li in it. A, it's Jet Li, but B, one of the cool things in that movie is that movie's about string theory alternate realities. So there's like an evil Jet Li in an alternate dimension, and he's trying to kill all the other versions of Jet Li in the multiverse because he, every time he kills one, he becomes more powerful. But
absorbs their power.
Exactly. But what they did was every single different iteration of the Jet Li character did a different style of kung fu and a different traditional style, which is totally nerdy and not necessary at all, but ties into the characters. And you have a little bit of that in The Matrix. Like, it's clear that, you know, not everyone's doing the same kung fu, which when stuff ripped off The Matrix after and all of a sudden in everything, everyone knew kung fu, they all knew the same kung fu. And
right, yeah.
Which is one thing that they miss. And for good martial arts fight choreographers, they tailor the style to the character. And that was done in this. So, like, Carrie Ann Moss has a very different kung fu style than they have for Keanu Reeves. And for, you know, it's done well. It's just not amazing.
So part of the not amazingness of Keanu Reeves's part, actually, in this film, later films, I guess, maybe did more or better. I don't know.
Well, he had
but
a fused
this,
spine.
This
didn't
one, he had like two fused vertebrae.
Yeah.
So
and I think
he couldn't really move a lot. So the first fight when he's like, I know kung fu, and then show me, and then he fights Lawrence Fishburne. It's really stiff. And in a weird way, I like watching that a lot more than I like watching Ben Affleck in Daredevil. But it reminds me of Ben Affleck in Daredevil. But Ben Affleck in Daredevil is just because he's, you know, a Southie or something. you know.
Yeah, and he wouldn't fight like that. He would have a much more barroom brawl style.
Right. So in Daredevil, he's just all kinds of stiff up against his future wife, who is a dancer who knows how to move her body and has all this confidence, and he's like just this board. Now, Keanu has one reason why he's a board, and that's his spine will break if he doesn't move it right.
But
his condition.
The choreographer used that within the context of the thing, you know, like, because one of the things about martial arts, and especially like traditional Chinese kung fu, is that people aren't supposed to get into an ideal shape. The styles are tailored for people's body type. So sort of anyone can do kung fu. You just have to find the right style of kung fu for your strengths.
Right. So Sammo Hung can do all sorts of crazy stuff because it works for Sammo Hung's build.
Right. He would specialize in a specific style of kung fu, or like, you know, someone, you know, they know wushu or southern style or something like that is more, you know, like when Bruce Lee was taking the best of all the different martial arts styles and developing Jeet Kune Do, he was also into bodybuilding. And traditional martial artists were like, you're out of your mind. That's a terrible idea. You'll be really stiff. Like, it's not good. It's not good to be muscular and do kung fu, was the sort of prevalent thought at the time.
Yeah, but then he came along and now everybody has to be as ripped as he is. And that's also interesting here, is that Keanu isn't. Keanu's never been ripped, like, ripped. He's been fine.
Yeah.
He's been good, but he's never been, like... No, he's been fine. His physique is fine.
He's fine.
I think I have a different way of saying fine.
As in, like,
Keanu is his fine.
Of course, Elvie. I know what you think of Keanu, but he's fine. He's basically like a surfer. Not Bruce Lee the surfer, but just a surfer. Not Anthony Kiedis.
Yeah.
So, but after Bruce Lee, everybody really has to be super chiseled and ripped. But yeah, that's interesting that you point out. I never considered that. Like, they would be super stiff and not be able to move too quickly. I mean, you think of somebody as big as Schwarzenegger. He's never done martial arts in movies.
Right.
But Dolph Lundgren has.
And is.
Dolph Lundgren does a specific kind, you know.
Well, Dolph Lundgren was the European kickboxing champion for a number of years as well. And, you know, pre-Rocky III, Rocky III? Rocky IV? Whatever one he's in?
IV.
You know, he wasn't as muscular as he is in that movie. They pumped him up to, you know, look like a boxer. But yeah, being muscular and doing martial arts are not necessarily married to each other.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I personally think The Matrix is kind of silly now. I don't think I hate it, but I can see your points. They're loud and clear. Yeah. And though I felt betrayed when I learned that Equilibrium was as stupid as it is, The Matrix doesn't hurt me that much to know that it's as stupid as it is.
Well, The Matrix isn't as... Well, this will sound weird, but it's not as preachy as Equilibrium, socially.
Socially. Hmm. Okay. Well, once you get to the second one, it starts getting there.
You know, I think... I know I have seen the two sequels, but I definitely slept through them. Definitely. They're, like, less green, right? They're more brown?
When you're inside of Zion, it's very amber brown. Yeah.
See, that's
and
that's
once
something I don't
you
like.
Get back into the Matrix, it turns green again. And so it's green, gray, or blue, and amber. Gray or blue is, like, when they're on the Nebuchadnezzar or any of those other hovercraft ships. And then, you know, the other two colors.
There's something weird about sci-fi movies to me, like, when it is sci-fi future, like, way in the future, like, everyone wears these brown, like, peasant clothes. I don't understand that.
Right.
And like in Firefly and stuff.
Yeah.
Brown.
I think there was a big move towards, like, let's not make it futuristic, it's more the Wild West, like, you know, offset the technology by, you know, making the clothes and fashion more, you know, old-fashioned.
Homesteader.
They just look like dirt.
Yeah. we call it Earth.
Dirt.
I prefer the, like, original Star Trek series looking sci-fi, where everything looks like it doesn't actually function, but it's very pretty and colorful.
Yeah.
That's my preference.
It looks clean and very... I mean, one of the things that sci-fi always kind of gets wrong, or not so much anymore, but traditionally was that when they'd show the future, everything was brand new and everything was from the same year. And that's not how things work. Like, if you walk around your neighborhood now and peep in your neighbor's windows, which I plan to do after this, you'll see, like, mid-century houses that have, you know, a wall-sized flat-screen television. Or, you know, like a 1800s Victorian house with a, you know, a ring camera system. You know, so it's always a mixture of things. So I think they kind of cottoned onto that in sci-fi in the, you know, turn of the century.
Yeah, I think so too. It's a good observation. So something else that's probably a good observation is your observation of the next film, which is your alternate to The Matrix.
Yes.
So your alternate being that it's your positive to The Matrix's negative.
Correct. And that would be Dark City, which came out in 1998.
New Line Cinema presents a startling new vision from the director of The Crow. On the edge of reality, and the threshold of illusion, lies a world beyond all imagination.
I call them the strangers. The city, everyone in it, is their experiment. They mix and match our memories.
There's no way out! Can you see?
Dark City, rated R.
So it came out a little less than a year before The Matrix, and is essentially the same story.
It's produced by one of the same producers who worked on The Matrix. Did you know this?
Yeah, because I think they're both New Line Cinema releases, I think.
They were both produced in Australia, and they used Warner Brothers lot down there in Australia, which was like a New Hollywood sort of thing, and they were trying to get more people to come on board. But I think this is a situation of a producer has an idea, and he just wants to keep stabbing at that idea until he gets it right or makes a hit.
No, because it makes sense that the Dark City would be in Australia because Alex Proyas, the director, is Australian. He had done The Crow previously and probably wanted to make a movie in his home country, I'm imagining.
Yeah, but that it was the same producer goes for a similar topic and a different approach.
Yeah. Although producers,
that's what I'm thinking of. You know, because like how David Lynch always goes back to, as a creator, he always goes back to the doppelganger concept or the split mentality thing that he has in at least three projects of his.
Right.
So I think this producer, he really likes the concept of a reality that is not what it seems.
Yeah, I mean, although I forget who said this originally, but there's an author who said there's only one plot, and no matter everything you've ever written and watched, there's only one plot, and that plot is things are not what they seem.
I guess so, yeah.
But, you know, it's, and also the producer doesn't necessarily have as much input, just because
creatively, no.
Yeah, because knowing Dark City is such an Alex Proyas movie, and The Matrix is such a Wachowski's whatever movie, that it's really kind of evident that I think part of it was probably also, too, that there was definitely that sort of stuff in the air in the late 90s because you had the sort of impending millennium stuff that was coming, you know.
Y2K bug.
Yeah, and we had a huge, like, exponentially world-changing shift in technology in a really short amount of time, whereas, you know, the internet basically became ubiquitous in 3 years. Like, you went from sort of war games nerds having it for 20 years to all of a sudden, you know, half of America has America Online, and then a year later, it's like the saturation is almost everybody. So I think that made a difference. You know, and you started seeing stuff like cell phones and technology sort of creeping into people's lives not at home, you know? So I think that was probably part of a lot of the stuff that was coming out at that time.
Yeah, it's weird too because of, you know, the early days of the internet, and I'm not talking about like when the military had it in the 60s or whatever, but like the early days of the internet when people would go on, what is it, MUAs?
Oh yeah, those BBSs or whatever they were.
Yeah, you know, they would just go on, you know, today it's like Second Life, right? Like that's the thing that people still do, Second Life.
Right.
But back then it was like they were living vicariously through this other reality, and it was all text-based, you know? So
the shift in how it went from text-based to like I think of a game like Myst, which was basically a text-based game, but had like a photorealistic reality within it.
Mm-hmm.
And that,
man, how I hated that game.
Yeah, but that blew.
There's no action to it.
No, but that blew everyone away. And
I know, but jumping from any kind of action side scroller, not a good one, just any of them, to Myst, you're looking at these really high res graphics, but they're still images with a little bit of water ripple somewhere in the background. And that's it.
But
it's like,
it made a splash, no pun intended, in the mainstream world where people who, you know, weren't video game nerds had heard of that all of a sudden, you know, and it was getting coverage.
Yeah.
So people started to sort of realize what was possible in those sorts of games. And you started to get games that were that sort of first person shooter style, which is inherently slightly more realistic. It's not quite the word, but it is more engulfing, you know?
Yeah. But what does that have to do with Dark City?
So Dark City is less technology based, but the things that Dark City does better than The Matrix is Dark City is derivative on purpose. It doesn't try to hide its derivativeness. It's actually sort of a key point to the plot. And the twist of Dark City is actually fairly well hidden and surprising. I feel like The Matrix from kind of scene one, I mean, obviously I knew what the twist was before watching it, but it's not difficult to work out. And in Dark City, it has this real lean in kind of like, what is going on here? And I'll give the plot away if people haven't seen it, but you basically have this sort of noir-y, people have seen Shape of Water. If you take Shape of Water and extract Amelie from it, you get Dark City visually. You know, it's greens and noir city, sort of 1940s, almost like Batman the Animated Series world. And you don't know what's going on, and everything looks like a world we know, but is slightly off. And then you start to see the strangers, and you're like, what are these people? They're like demons. What are they? What is going on? Uh-huh. And it turns.
Describe the strangers first. Describe them for a second.
Due to a glitch, Ken's description of the villains in Dark City was rendered inaudible. He says they are similar to Cenobites from Hellraiser, mixed with Men in Black and Kane from Poltergeist 2.
Now, I wonder if Buffy and Doctor Who were informed by these guys, because these guys seem like they came before Hush and whatever the Doctor Who things were.
Very much so. I think they were influenced by that for sure.
Yeah.
And they all have names that are not names people have. Mr. Sleep, Mr. You know, they're very. And that all fits into the plot, because what we find out eventually is that these are extraterrestrials that are a hive mind, and that's not their real form. They're essentially possessing the bodies of dead human beings in order to interact with this world so that the hive mind can do things. And
they can learn how to be, because they're dying.
Right. So essentially what they've done is they've kidnapped all these people, built a sort of terrarium world so that they could just do these constant social experiments to see what gives human beings individuality, to sort of discover what the human soul is. So they're all the subjects of this experiment. And
it's already fathoms more interesting than the Matrix.
Yeah, but literally the same concept, but such a better execution and a more philosophical, smarter
execution. Without saying it's philosophical.
Exactly.
Not one single moment that is outwardly expressing philosophy.
Yeah, at no point no one goes like, but what does it mean to be human? Or like, it's just it's such a well done movie that you pick up on this stuff without being beat over the head with it.
Right. I also like it more because it's an exercise in storytelling. Like, it's actually storytelling. And The Matrix, it's not telling a story, it's like, here's what's happening.
Yeah.
You know what
it's showing you a story instead of telling you a story.
And
I think Dark City, I think, is a movie that does not get nearly enough credit and love for what it is. And when the first DVD came out, Roger Ebert actually did a commentary for it because he loved that movie so much.
He's got an essay with it. There's like an essay that he wrote, and it's an accessible PDF or something like that on it. And I'm amazed. Like, Roger Ebert, sometimes I just think that he's wrong about things. I actually think that he's like a sexually repressed guy, so there's a lot of things that he's like knee-jerk and holy crap, that's the worst.
Yeah.
And it's like not the worst, but it's only the worst because of his hang-ups. And then there's something like this where his commentary, his essay, they're all spot on. They're all like, yes, you're absolutely correct.
He realizes how, I don't think he says this in the movie, but my takeaway from Dark City is that is a movie about artifice in a lot of ways. It's telling a story about stories and why we have them. Because what the strangers are doing to these people is that they're constantly wiping their memories and giving them new ones and putting them in new situations and new roles to see how it changes how they react. And
now the best example of this is the two people sitting eating dinner, and they're having a blue collar, salt of the earth worker and his wife dinner, and then having like the small talk about that and talking about work, and then once they're changed over and reprogrammed, their memories are injected into their foreheads, actually.
Right.
They wake up, and now they're super rich hoity-toities.
Right.
You know?
And will that change who they are? Does circumstance change who they are as a person? And that really is a metaphor for movie and for actors and for telling stories and why we tell them. And, you know, do they give us insights into ourselves and all these, you know, all these different things? And in that respect, it makes perfect sense that this movie would be so steeped in imagery of like German expressionist films and film noir and Blade Runner and, you know, all these sorts of things that came before it. So the derivativeness is sort of integral to the concept of the movie. And so for me, as someone who loves movies, it's like a perfect movie for people who love movies.
Well, I'm with you on it because I've actually always liked this more than The Matrix. It's just The Matrix has kung fu in it, and I like that too, right?
Right.
So I think I've seen The Matrix a lot more, probably just for the stupid eye candy experience of that. Like, eye candy being martial arts and acrobatics.
Right.
But for my mind, I'd go for Dark City.
But Dark
City, I really would. Like,
but Dark City looks.
I don't want to watch Matrix ever again, by the way.
But Dark City looks like you could watch Dark City with the sound off. And it's engaging. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. And the design of it, like every single just pixel of frame and picture in that movie, you can pause and just soak it in. It just looks great.
It's also got a cast that is incredibly strong.
Yes.
You got John Hurt being very subdued. This is his best ever role outside of Until the End of the World.
Yeah.
And
oh, William Hurt.
William Hurt. I say John because I'm wrong.
But I don't know.
It's William Hurt.
He's great in like Altered States.
I don't like Altered States at all. There's too little too late in Altered States. There's not enough weird in it. It's like 2 minutes long. Not enough weird for me. But he's just so good and subtle as the cop trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Rufus Sewell is also great as the serial killer that he isn't. And that's that whole plot with Melissa George being a victim. And she's great even though she's got like 2 minutes in the movie. That whole plot is actually just barely there. It's barely there for only just the hook at the beginning. Oh no, who's a serial killer? He's a serial killer? Tickle, tickle.
Right.
Until, like, they pull... And they actually rather quickly sideline that story. They just have the cops going after him constantly.
Right.
And then Jennifer Connelly also. Very, very good. Does she actually sing her own songs?
She doesn't. She doesn't. There are two songs in the movie she doesn't do her own singing. But she also has a very sort of aloof but alluring and sort of haunting sort of mystery to her just as an actress. And it's perfect for that movie. And I love things like, you know, William Hurt's detective character has like a really silly affectation. Like they have him play the accordion when he's trying to think, you know, like right. which is such a silly movie thing, but would be a thing that, like, you know, these strangers who might as well be producers or non-creative people, basically that's what they are. They're people who aren't creative, who are trying to figure
Kiefer
out.
Because Kiefer Sutherland is the creator. He's a screenwriter.
Right.
Kiefer Sutherland is a screenwriter, basically.
But he's their slave. You know, he's like, I don't want to do this.
So
I don't know what they want.
My understanding is that Kiefer Sutherland's character is a philosopher or somebody. He doesn't quite explain how he knows how to do what he does.
He's a doctor of some sort.
He's a doctor of some sort. So a psychologist. So he's like a psychologist, philosopher, whatever a brain dude does.
Right.
I don't know. But he's got a lot of those elements. But okay, Kiefer Sutherland was in Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm. Fire Walk with Me. Yep.
And he told David Lynch after he saw the movie, he's like, "You should have told me to turn it up a bit. I could totally be weirder for you." And David Lynch just had him do what he did. You're good. No, you're good. Right. So I think this is his response. If I'm gonna be in a weird movie, I'm gonna be in a weird movie.
And he goes way over the top. Like he's basically doing a Peter Lorre impression in the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that this was his response to, like I swung soft. I'm going to swing really hard this time. I swung soft with Fire Walk With Me, but I'm going to go really hard this time. And he does. And I think his is the most artificial character in that sense.
Right.
How he portrays it. But I still think it works for the film.
Yeah, I would agree.
But also, we're talking about the cast then. The strangers. There's all kinds of big actors going on here.
Richard O'Brien.
Richard O'Brien, the tall man, but not the tall man from Phantasm, the guy from Mad Max.
Oh, yes, yes. It's, what's his name?
Ian Richardson, something like that?
Yeah, isn't he like the Master Blaster guy in Mad Max?
No, the gyrocopter.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Okay. I know what you're talking
about. Pilot.
Yeah, yeah. And Richard O'Brien was actually the inspiration for all of the Strangers. So the whole, when he was...
him?
Yeah, well, when Alex Proyas was writing that movie, he pictured Richard O'Brien in Rocky Horror.
You're going to kick yourself. I think I'm going to kick myself. It's Bruce Spence. That's
Yes.
Like, duh.
But that's who we pictured, like him actually as that character was a riffraff in that movie, and then just cast him. It's just easier.
Cut off the middleman.
Absolutely. And they're creepy, and they're inhuman, but it's uncanny and weird and very thought out. It's a smart movie, but it doesn't come across as pretentious.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas the
there's another thing that you can say about The Matrix.
It's dumb and pretentious, and Dark City's smart and not pretentious.
Yes. Now, there's another thing. I mentioned Twin Peaks, okay, and David Lynch. Okay, fine. But this little kid alien in Dark City,
yes,
there's a little kid version of him. I was totally hit by the Dune little girl, Alia, vibe.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Like, who I think Alicia really deliberate.
Alicia Witt plays her, I think, in Dune.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, children are unsettling to people generally, and a sort of weird vampiric child that's actually an old man is really unsettling.
Yeah, so it really felt like, you know that scene in Dune with that little girl who's like, "Kill him, my brother."
Yeah.
Like, yeah, let's get a kid that looks kind of like that. It doesn't have to be a girl. I mean, probably not, because all the others are dudes, so yeah, let's just get this little kid and vibe that kid from that movie into this other movie, you know.
Right.
Sorry, I like Dune a lot.
You know what I want to do? I want to go back in time and cast Jennifer Connelly and Melissa George as Betty and Veronica.
Oh boy, I've done that many times.
But seriously, I'm like, every time I watch this movie, I forget Melissa George is in it. Then I'm like, Melissa George!
Oh yeah.
I think she's rad.
Yeah, no, it's very well cast. And a movie with an automat, and I'll watch any movie that has an automat.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I've never heard of it until that.
You know what's weird is every time I see an automat, I'm like, this bell goes off in my brain or something, where I'm like, oh, I know what that is. Like, I don't know how to explain it other than that, because it's just something I've never actually experienced in life. Like,
well, they were mostly an East Coast thing, especially the Northeast, uh-huh. And they were mostly all gone by the late 70s. We had one uh-huh. here in Boston that went until the mid 80s, so I have very limited memories of it from when I was a really small kid. But yeah, I think they're pretty obscure, but they're so cool.
Yeah, I mean, I know what it is from the movie, but I've never experienced it at all. I don't get the appeal of really weird or like maybe like a Russian roulette of sandwiches.
Well,
you don't know what kind of food poisoning you're gonna get.
Well, each window is a different food, so it's basically like a diner cafeteria mixed with post office boxes.
Yes.
Yeah, you put your quarter or money into a slot and then you open the door and you get your sandwich or your pie or whatever. But it just seems, I don't know why it seems this way, but I don't do buffets either. It just seems like it's poison waiting to happen.
Well, I mean, it's fresh food. You know, there's a kitchen back there. Basically, they were invented during the Great Depression as a way to cut out extra costs like wait staff so that you could do self-serve, but it was still hot food. So it made the food like half the price.
Okay. That makes sense. So I'm just assuming that it's just sitting there all day.
It's not a vending machine.
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming. I'm assuming it's more like a vending machine. Okay. I've been corrected. Understand. I get it.
It's a great movie.
Yeah. I think from, you know, just this conversation that we can all agree that Dark City is a better movie than The Matrix.
Why do you think it's not as beloved?
Ooh, because it's not as easy?
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't have kung fu in it.
That's probably true.
It doesn't have a cool industrial score. Or, you know, like, it seems more pop 90s. You know?
Yeah, I feel like the ending too is, although they're almost the same exact ending between The Matrix and Dark City, believe it or not, the ending in Dark City seems less hopeful. Like, it seems less like a win.
Yeah.
Like, well, it is open-ended, right? But he's now the god of this place, I guess. And what now? He doesn't know how to do that.
Right.
So it's not just like the Matrix has him flying and, oh, he can fly, but he can fly in a computer simulator, so big deal. But, oh, he can fly and he can go wake people up. But here he's, Rufus Sewell is like, yeah, okay, I'm going to like actually make a beach, but now what? I'm going to go sit on the beach. Now what?
But that's the free will piece. That's the piece where be careful what you wish for, or are you better off with free will? Is that enough of a win? Whereas thinking about it in the Matrix, he still doesn't have free will. He has the ability to sort of, is proselytize the word I'm looking for? Because they basically want him to go create this new world and then tell people about it and wake them up and have them join him. Whereas,
join him in Grand Theft Auto sandbox video.
Right.
Game.
Whereas in Dark City, it's, well, we have our freedom now. What do we do with it?
Yeah.
And also this thing that they're on is a dark city and it's always been turned away from the sun so that they're, now they can get sun, I guess. Yes, theoretically. Also, this is kind of like a spaceship.
It is a spaceship, yeah.
Fly it. He could just fly it wherever. He could maybe try to figure out where Earth is. But how?
Right.
How?
Right.
Right? There's all this open-ended, like, daunting to it. Not just this, like, saccharine, hopeful thing that the Matrix does.
Right.
Saccharine.
Yeah. It really is.
Really, like,
I don't think I've ever heard anyone describe the Matrix as saccharine.
Oh, no, but in comparison, definitely it is. It's a little, here, have a placebo piece of candy, you know?
Right.
Or the
right.
Other one is just like, you're kind of screwed, maybe, or maybe not.
Yeah.
So, Ken, thank you so much for coming on our show and being on the very first episode of our podcast, and thank you for being a part of our website too.
You're welcome. Thanks for putting up with me and allowing me to do so.
And you know, you can come back too if you'd like.
Yeah, we'll see if I'm around. I might be kidnapped and be on an alien spaceship with Jennifer Connelly.
Well, hope.
Well, I won't disturb you then.
Yeah, you can always wish about that.
It'd be funny if Keanu Reeves created the Matrix after he took control to just be Dark City. Or not even, to just have them all watching the movie Dark City.
Better movie. Well, we know that you have other movies that you don't like.
Oh, there's plenty.
And I'm sure there are other movies that you do like, so you are obviously welcome back again.
Excellent.
So, everybody, that's the first episode.
We did it.
I think we're done.
We did it.
So, LB, that was it. That was our show. Our first episode in the can.
You mean inaugural episode, Andrew?
Yes.
We're on a podcast. You have to say inaugural to get the right points.
Is that a thing?
Yes.
Being fancy?
Yes.
On a podcast?
Yes.
I thought people were just like, MF this, MF that, and so on.
Well, no, I mean, I know some people are a little obnoxious like that, but really, it's like podcast bingo. You have to say inaugural.
Hmm.
Sorry.
Okay, so that was our inaugural
Ding.
Podcast.
And it was awesome having Ken on.
Oh, yeah, of course. He's always a good guest. On my previous podcasts that I've had him on, very good. Very solid. Always a contributor. Like, off the top of his head, he can have a conversation with anybody. I heard him once have a conversation with these two kids that didn't know horror movies.
Uh-huh.
It was almost an excruciating podcast because we were like, what? What's that? But he was like rolling with every punch. Like, there weren't punches because they were like little noodle arms. But still, he was like, yeah, here's a movie that you guys haven't heard of. You guys should check it out. Yeah, it's good. What? I have never heard of that. Halloween 3, what? I'm joking. That's not what he said. But still, my point is, the dude is a consummate professional.
Yes. And you can find Ken on Twitter. He is at Kenneth W. Reed. Like we said, it's R-E-I-D. You can go to iCanRead.com or just listen to the TV Guidance Counselor podcast. You'll have a great time with it. So, of course, you should check us out at Grumpire.com or on Twitter at Grumpire Online. Now, we are on Spotify as well, and you can check us out at Grumpire. There, we have some cool playlists that we do every week, so that's fun, in addition to our podcast being available on Spotify to listen to. We're on iTunes, of course. You can leave us a review or a rating. That'd be really awesome. And Stitcher, too. We're everywhere, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that does it, though. So this has been our first episode.
You mean inaugural?
Yes.
Okay. And I promise to not ever do that horrible Ed McMahon.
So anyway, we're signing off now, but we're here to remind you, don't let them break your stride about having a negative opinion on a movie.